how we perceive the assembly and how we dress. And in that first week, we talked about the New Testament concept of modesty, how modesty in the New Testament seems primarily to be concerned with not imitating the wealthy, not excessive ornamentation, but dressing with simplicity, avoiding the trappings of wealth. And above all, it does seem that there's an underlying principle that our clothing isn't to draw attention to ourselves. We are instead to draw attention to God through our good works and the quality of our character. And as I close that lesson, I urged us all just to be sensitive to the various consciences that are among us, that if we know that there are brethren who prefer a more formal attire, especially on Sunday morning, that we who maybe have a more casual approach should be sensitive to that, and vice versa. The second topic we talked about last week was the development of public speakers and teachers. And in that class, we talked about the New Testament pattern showing us that God wanted multiple men to participate in that activity within the assembly. We also noted that the burden of responsibility falls upon the shoulders of those who have been gifted, so gifted by God, that we have to answer to God for putting those gifts to work. But we also talked toward the end about how if we aren't gifted in this direction, how it is possible to develop those skills through hard work and through the church giving us opportunities, not just to exercise those skills, but also to fail. Because as I noted toward the end of last week's class, we need amateur hour in the church. Amateur hour is absolutely essential to properly developing public speakers and teachers for the future. This week, we're going to shift our attention to why are we different from other churches? The overarching theme for these 4 weeks is looking at the first century church, placing it in not just a scriptural context, but also an historical context, and considering the things that we practice, what we do as a congregation, are those founded in the scriptures, and does history agree? So tonight we're going to begin talking about why the Church of Christ is different from churches around it. And I'd like to just make the statement that, at least for my part, and I know I'm not alone in this room, at least for my part, the reason why we are different is a matter of conviction and not of preference. I choose to be a member of a Church of Christ because I believe in what the church stands for. I believe in what the church teaches. This is on the basis of conviction. I don't have family holding me here. I'm here because I believe it, and I hope that there are many like me in the audience tonight. And in particular this evening, we're going to talk about how the first century church worshiped God through their music. This was one of the topics that the elders asked me to speak about. Like last week, I do plan to spend a little bit of time quoting from some modern day scholars on this topic, but I also hope to give you some things from the scriptures to consider as well. Let's begin with a quote from a man by the name of Everett Ferguson, who I mentioned last week. Everett Ferguson, in the last half of last century, was one of the most respected scholars, one of the most respected experts in what's often called the patristic age of the church, particularly the first, second, third, and fourth centuries. So basically, from the founding of the church until the Council of Nice in 325 AD. That's his area of specialty, so to speak. And in his book, A Cappella Music and the Public Worship of the Church, on page 47, he has this to say: "There remains no evidence that instrumental music was used in the synagogue service. Indeed, this holds true until comparatively recent times. The real reason for this absence is probably that advanced by James William McKinnon, namely that the instrument was simply irrelevant to the type of worship developed in the synagogue. It was a non-sacrificial worship and a rational service to which, as an extension of either prayer or of reading the scriptures, had been added the chanting of the Psalms." Now, this quote has a lot packed into it. I'd like to just pull out a few salient points. First of all, I'd like you to notice that as far as the synagogue is concerned, the use of instruments in its worship is a much later development, something that happened more in the last few centuries as opposed to what was happening early on. In fact, as we're going to see on the next slide, synagogues in the first century were vocal in their music. And as we talked about last week, if we're looking for a foreshadow of the church and the type of worship service that happened in the first century church, we need not look to the temple. The temple was far different. The temple was concerned with pageantry, with sacrifice. It was very emotional. Whereas the synagogue, as Ferguson notes here, was more rational in the sort of service it provided, the sort of worship that it participated in. And I think you can see the undertones of New Testament Christianity in this quotation. Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 comes to mind, our reasonable service, our rational service, that like the synagogue, we depend upon reading from the Word of God, expressing our prayers to God, singing to God, and teaching from the Word of God. It is a service of the mind as opposed to a service of the emotions, of the senses, if you will. So it's radically different than what the temple had to offer. And the synagogue really was the forerunner for the church, at least the worship of the church. Andrew B. McGowan, another man I mentioned last week, who is an ordained Anglican priest, he's the president and dean of the Berklee School of Divinity, wrote a book called Ancient Christian Worship. I mentioned this last week. It's a fairly recent book. You can buy it on Amazon as I did, and I read it in preparation for this class. And in his book, on page 115, he has this to say. It seems likely that some forms of psalm singing already practiced in Judaism were known to Christians across early centuries, and that musical developments in both traditions may have been spurred on by interaction, as well as by initial Christian borrowing. It is worth noting that as practice in both early Christianity and the forms of Judaism located in the synagogues emerges into clearer view, vocal music is in evidence far more than instrumental. Now, Dr. McGowan has, I believe, a more humanistic view of the development of the church, and that comes out in his quotation. He talks about the growth of the church as more of an organic thing, more of a human-directed thing, as opposed to what we believe, which it was directed by the Holy Spirit speaking through apostles and prophets. However, he does talk about how the church shared with the synagogue, the early church shared with the synagogue, this practice of vocal music. And he goes so far to say that the strongest evidence is that vocal music, and not instrumental music, was present in both the synagogue and the first century church. And this is the consensus of any serious scholar that you read when it comes to the history of music in the church. When it comes to the first century, almost everyone agrees that vocal music was the mode of expressing song to God. I don't really know of anyone who disputes that particular point. So, going back to what we talked about last week, with the synagogue as sort of the foreshadowing of the church, we can see that just like the synagogue, which chanted psalms, sang psalms to one another, so too the church carried on that as it worshiped God in its services. Now, like the last couple weeks, I'm just going to keep on going unless I see hands. So this is a little summation here. If you got a question or comment, now's a good time. If I don't see any hands, I'm going to keep on moving. Everybody good? We're good. Okay, let's keep on pushing here. Well, let's turn our attention now to the New Testament. And there are some examples of instruments being mentioned in the New Testament. Let's take the instrument that I played in college and high school, although the trumpets, as far as the New Testament times and Old Testament times were concerned, were very different than our modern trumpet, but the trumpet is mentioned some 13 times in the New Testament, and how it is used, I think, is important to notice. 10 times the trumpet is used as a tool for announcement, like 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Jesus will descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of an archangel, with the trumpet of God. Jesus is a king returning to gather his kingdom, and like a king coming in victorious, he is going to be heralded, announced by a trumpet. Now, whether or not that will be a literal trumpet, or whether it will just be something that sounds like a trumpet, I don't know, but I can't wait to find out. But this is just one of, well, this is the major way that the trumpet is used in the New Testament. It's used as a tool of announcement. Twice in the New Testament, the voice of Christ is compared to a trumpet. The 13th occurrence, I think, is worth noting. And you all have studied Revelation recently, so I'm assuming a little bit of familiarity on your part. In the 18th chapter of Revelation, the angels that are carrying out this vision for John are talking about how the kings of the earth are going to lament the fall of the great city, the great harlot, Babylon. And as you might recall, of course, I wasn't here for Kyle's class, but I'm assuming that he and I agree on this particular point. I believe that Babylon, the harlot, the great city, represents the apostate church. And it's interesting to me, and I don't want to make too much of this, but God doesn't do things by accident. In Revelation chapter 18, 22, it is said that the sound of harpists, musicians, flutists, and trumpeters shall not be heard in you anymore. And this is talking about Babylon, apostate Babylon. Now, I wouldn't be overly dogmatic about that, but again, God is telling us something by placing that statement in mourning to Babylon. So we find trumpets popping up in that particular instance as well. We have some miscellaneous references to instruments in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 1 is another good example. Paul talks about speaking in tongues with no love, and one who speaks in tongues with no love has become like sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. Later on in chapter 14, verse number 7, he talks of instruments as having no life, whether flute or harp. It seems to me, based upon my survey of the New Testament, that primarily instruments are used as a means of comparison, as a metaphor, of helping us understand something by speaking of them in a figurative way. What I find compelling about that is singing is always talked about in a very literal way, whereas instruments are used figuratively. And again, I don't think that that's by mistake. Singing is treated as a literal form of expressing worship, whereas instruments are always used in a very figurative way in the New Testament. Of course, the question that often comes up whenever we talk about whether or not instruments should be present in the church is Revelation chapter 5, verse 8. Well, wait a second. There's harps in heaven. Harps in heaven. So you're saying that there's harps in heaven, but there's not harps in the church. Revelation 5, verse number 8 is one of those instances where we find harps mentioned in the New Testament. Of course, in that verse, we find not just harps, but we also find Jesus described as a lamb. Now, is Jesus a literal lamb? Well, no, right? He's not a literal lamb. He's called a lamb because that talks of his sacrifice, his sinless, pure sacrifice for the sins of the world. Also in that verse, the 24 elders are holding bowls of incense, which we are told represent the prayers of the saints. So, figurative lamb, figurative incense, but literal harps. I don't think so. That just doesn't seem to fit in a section that is full of imagery. Not all of Revelation is intended to be interpreted symbolically. There are portions of Revelation that can be taken literally. Chapters 2 and 3 are an example. I think chapter 18, which we were talking about a little bit earlier, the mourning and lamentation over the fall of Babylon, much of that is also be taken literally as well. Here, though, we have a passage that is heavily symbolic. Therefore, I conclude the harps must be representative of something, just like the incense is representative of something, as is the lamb. And I'm not alone in that interpretation. Dr. McGowan, who I mentioned a few slides ago, had this to say. The revelation of John depicts heavenly instruments without hesitation. the living creatures and elders, each holding a kithara, a harp, and a bowl of incense, fall down before the Lamb. But since incense does not seem to have been used in Christian assemblies of the first century, we cannot assume too much about earthly harps either. That last part is absolutely correct. The first century church did not use literal incense, so we should not assume that the harps in heaven give us some sort of pattern for the church. If the incense is symbolic, then the harps must also be symbolic. So as far as the New Testament is concerned, instruments are used as a means of comparison. Literal singing is emphasized, but instruments seem to be used more in a figurative sense in almost all cases. Now, I guess I will pause for a second because this next section may take me the rest of the time. Any questions or comments up to this point? Yeah, Bill, go ahead. I agree, and it does seem that that fits together with what we have in Ephesians chapter 5, verse number 19, singing and making melody in your heart. The harp seems to be representative of the hearts of the saints, if you will, just as the incense is representative of the prayers of the saints. And that's also good to bear in mind that praying and singing often go side by side in the New Testament. There's a number of different places we could point to where that's the case. So thank you for that comment. Any other questions, comments? Ed, go ahead.
The other thing, too, is we're supposed to worship in spirit.
Yes.
And I've heard it said, you know, a mechanical instrument doesn't have spirit.
Yeah.
So our singing does, but musical instruments don't.
Yeah. And that takes me back to what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 14 and 7, things that do not have life. We have life because God has given us a spirit. We're spiritual beings. God has placed his spirit in us. So, yeah, I think all that fits together. Yes, Christy, go ahead.
Are you going to go into at all the history of when it did become more prominent in churches and the reasons why? At all, I'm curious.
I hadn't planned to because my specific purview is to place things in a first century context, so I hadn't planned to go on, but it is a later development. One of the interesting things that you note, the men who wrote in the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries, sometimes they're called the Anti-Nicene Fathers, the patristic writers, they speak speak against instruments quite a lot. They see this as going back to the temple form of worship, which was to be avoided, and they also see it as using the form of entertainment that was popular in the culture in that day and age. So many of the same reasons that we would argue against them, they do as well. And those writers are kind of a two-edged sword. For every good point they make, they can make a whole bunch of bad ones too. But on that particular topic, there's actually quite a bit of unanimity. This was something that the church held on to for many centuries. In fact, the Greek Orthodox Church to this day, as far as I know, the last I knew, when I last talked with a Greek Orthodox member of the Greek Orthodox Church, they did not use instruments in their worship for the same reasons that we don't. It wasn't something that was done in the first century church. There's a little bit there for you, but no, I intend to stay in the first century. Jerry, go ahead.
Wait,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Means according to the chapter.
Yes.
That was interesting to me because the word's been around. That's not a 2000 or 1900 word. I mean, that's been around for a long time.
Yes, it
said according to the chapel. Well, the original or early churches or chapels was really a lot more like the synagogue.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last I knew, the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican continues to use a cappella music for that reason. That's the last I knew. Now, that may have changed recently, but the last I knew, they continue to use a cappella music. They see this as trying to be a more pure form of worship, if you will, closer to what the early church had. So, yeah, this is not an odd idea. It's only become odd in the last couple of centuries. So, anything else? Well, I admit I've got a lot of misgivings about this next section, but I feel like we need to take a little bit of a nosedive here into something that I feel does need to be addressed. I debated whether or not to even include these 8 or 9 slides this evening, and I may regret this after I'm done, I don't know. I'd like to spend a few minutes talking about the Greek word psalo. And there's actually a really good reason for that, and that'll become apparent here in just a moment. And I do this, I know that there are people in here whose eyes are going to glaze over and you're going to be bored to tears, and I get that, I understand that. But there is an idea that is in our churches that I think needs to be addressed, and that is a disagreement over the Greek word psalo. In Ephesians chapter 5, verse number 19, Paul tells the church to speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Now, I have italicized the two words making melody because those two words come from the single Greek word psalo. I would like to take a few minutes tonight to just determine how a first century Christian would have understood what Paul was saying in the context of that particular language. And the reason why I think that this is a matter that is worth addressing is because of some confusion that stems from the definition of this word in Strong's Exhaustive Concordance and other lexicons like Thayer's and others I could mention. I just took a screenshot from my Bible program of Strong's Exhaustive Concordance of the definition of psalo. And he says, probably strengthened from psal, to rub, to touch the surface, to twitch or twang, that is, to play on a stringed instrument, to celebrate the divine worship with music and accompanying odes, to make melody, sing psalms. Some folks have taken this as an indication that because the notion of a stringed instrument is within the definition of psalo, that the Holy Spirit is giving us permission to include instruments in the worship of the church. But let's look at how psalo is translated throughout the New Testament. In Romans chapter 15, verse number 9, Paul quotes from Psalm 18:49. He says, "For this reason I will confess to you among the Gentiles and sing to your name." Sing there, italicized and underlined, is from the Greek word psalo. Ephesians 5:19, which I've just mentioned, and I should, I'll just point this out real quick. Singing is a separate Greek word. That's the Greek word ado.
A-D-O.
It's where we get our word adore, which I think makes a great deal of sense, right? Yeah. Ado, singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse number 15. I will sing with the understanding. That's psalo again. James chapter 5, verse number 13. This entire phrase comes from one Greek word. Let him sing psalms, coming from the Greek word psalo. So in the four instances that it occurs in the New Testament, psalo is translated by all New Testament translators as either to sing or to make melody. So the question is, if psalo means to play in the New Testament, which is what some people will contend, why doesn't anyone translate it that way? Here we have a word that is translated the same way, except for one exception here in Ephesians 5:19, and the reason why I think will become clear the more I go through this lesson. Why doesn't anyone translate it to play? If that's a meaning for the word, why not translate it that way? Well, the reason is because psalo, the meaning of psalo, evolved. And words evolve. The meaning of words evolve. Colossians chapter 3, verse number 5 from the King James says, "Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. Now, the King James Version that folks in this audience are using is a revision from 1769. And the word mortify in 1769 meant something a little different than how we use it in 2018. And those of us that have more modern translation know that the word mortify means to what? To put to death, right? Put to death, and that's how it was being used back in 1769 primarily. In 2018, if you look up the word mortify, you'll find the definition: to cause someone to feel embarrassed, ashamed, or humiliated. If I said, I am mortified, you'd understand what I meant, that I'm embarrassed or I've been humiliated by someone or something that's taken place. It's not that I'm being put to death, but rather I am ashamed, caused to be ashamed. And the same thing is happening with the word psalo. Just as mortify changed in meaning from 1769 to the present day, so too psalo changed its primary meaning. The meaning of psalo evolved. Now, in classical Greek, sometimes called Attic Greek, which I'm just using these dates as sort of a point on a timeline, if you will. So from about 500 to 300 BC, in classical Greek, that word meant to play. But in E.A. Sophocles' Greek lexicon of the Roman and Byzantine periods from B.C. 146 to A.D. 1100, he offers a very different definition. He says psalo means to chant, sing religious hymns. He's giving us a lexicon of what these words meant in this period of time over the course of these 1200 years. So we see that although it meant one thing in classical Greek, by the time he began writing his lexicon, in the time period that he was covering with that lexicon, the word's meaning had shifted. By 300 AD, psalo was known among all Greek speakers as to sing. So over a period of about 800 years, you have an evolution from to play to sing. Now here's the problem. Strong's Dictionary doesn't give you any of that information, does it? Strong's Dictionary just tells you this is one of the meanings of that word. It doesn't tell you what was happening in the language at the time. It doesn't tell you that by the first century, Greek-speaking Jews understood that psalo meant to sing. It doesn't tell you that. That's the danger of hitching your wagon to the definition in a lexicon. You don't have enough information to make that sort of determination. And we can see this evolution in the Septuagint. We can see the evolution of psalo being used to play, evolving into to sing as well, and eventually by the New Testament time, it was being used primarily as to sing. The Hebrew word nagon, remember the Septuagint? Is a translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek. The Hebrew word nagon that's often translated psalo, in fact, it may only be translated psalo in the Septuagint, always has to do with instrumental music. It's very specific, has a very specific meaning. 1 Samuel chapter 16, verses 16 through 18 is just one example. But there's another Greek word, Hebrew word that's translated psalo, and that's the Hebrew word zamar, which is more general in its meaning. It just simply means to make melody. And if you think back to Ephesians chapter 5, verse number 19, what does Paul say? Singing and making melody in your heart to the Lord. Psalo. I realized this morning that this slide has way too much information. So I will send this to everyone digitally via email later tonight. Because this is just a waterfall of information. The reason I put this slide together, though, is I wanted to see every instance of zamar being translated into psalo in the Old Testament and just to see what the context bore out. And what is interesting about this is, in this top row and in this bottom row, psalo is associated with either making melody on an instrument or singing with an instrumental accompaniment. But notice in these middle three rows, the overwhelming number of occurrences of psalo in the Psalms has to do with vocal music. So you can see the transition beginning to take place, how we're moving from to play to sing. And remember, the Septuagint was the version of the Old Testament that every Jewish Christian outside of Palestine was going to be reading, because they're all Greek speakers. That's what this could be read in their synagogues, and when they came to Christ, that was what was going to be read in the churches as well. They would have understood that psalo meant to sing, because you could see that evolution taking place in the Septuagint. Like I said, there's way too much information on that particular slide, so I'll send that to you digitally. What this draws me to conclude about the use of psalo in the Septuagint is that the Hebrew word zamar into psalo, the translation of that word, frequently conveyed the idea of vocal, not instrumental music. There are more instances of it referring to vocal music and not to instrumental music in the Septuagint, which means that the use of psalo in the Septuagint does not inherently include the use of instruments. I shouldn't look at that word and conclude, oh, well, that has to have an instrument involved, because that's in the history of the word. That's in the meaning of the word, the etymology of the word. Everett Ferguson talked about the evolution of this word. And I included this because I think he gives us a really good perspective. This is a man who has looked into these matters, and I realize this is an appeal to authority, but this is a guy that knows the area a lot better than any of us in this room, and this is what he has to say. Since a special vocal use of psalo is first and most clearly attested in Jewish religious literature, and since the Psalms were recited without instrumental accompaniment in the synagogue services, a reasonable hypothesis may be suggested for the change in the usage of the word. The change in practice in the synagogue, so that the Psalms were used without instrumental accompaniment that had characterized their use in the temple, produced a change of the meaning in the word so that it meant to sing the Psalms. The difference in the way the Psalms were used changed the meaning of psalo, which was employed to describe this use. Christians derived their use of the word from the Greek, from the Jewish circles in which the church began, not from classical Greek usage. What he's saying is, because the synagogue did not use instruments, and because psalo had a broader meaning than just to play, that the use of vocal music helped the meaning of the word evolve over time. So by the time we reach the first century, any Greek-speaking Jew who uses the word psalo is going to be talking about singing, not playing. And that just carried forward into the church as well. So here's why I included all this information. When a first century Christian opened up the book of Ephesians, and they got to chapter 5, verse 19, and they read the phrase, adontes kai psalentes in te cardia. They would not have concluded that that means singing and making melody with your kithara, with your harp, with your heart. That's not what they would have concluded. They would have understood Paul's meaning exactly, that he was saying singing and making melody with your voice, with your heart, that this was singing and not playing. I bring this up because, brethren, we have got to be very careful that we do not build our beliefs on the definition of a Greek word in a lexicon. It's dangerous territory because we don't know all the history that's behind it. That lexicon doesn't give us all the information that we need to make an informed decision. And that's certainly not enough information for me to base my salvation. There's got to be more to it. So if we're going to make an argument for the Greek, we need to do the due diligence, do the investigation that it requires, look into it, and make sure that we understand why Strong's is defining it that way, or Thayer's is defining it that way, or BDAG or Little and Scott or any of the other Greek lexicons that are out there. Make sure we understand the history of the word before we begin hitching our wagons to that particular belief. All right, I'm out of slides, so you're going to have to start talking. Any questions or comments? And like I said, I know that's a lot of information, but I'll send this to you digitally. Jerry, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I agree.
But that's my limited understanding.
Sure. And it's a little murky. I mean, getting into how music was actually sung in the first century church, I have yet really to find anything that gives me a clear indication as to how that looked, what it looked like. I know Amanda's taking music history courses as well. I haven't found anything that really gives me any satisfaction on it. Call and response may have been one of the things that they did. You have a leader who would sing a line and then the congregation would sing it back to them. That may have been one of the ways that they went about, which is very different than what even the way we do it here. But the important point is it was singing. It's singing. And it goes back, I think, to the engaging of the mind, the engaging of the spirit, the appeal to the rational side of man as opposed to the appeal to the emotional side of man, which I think is the danger with instrumental music, which is why the Lord doesn't include it in the church. Gerald, go ahead.
One of the questions that I get when I visit with people about this subject is, well, does this really matter to God as long as a person is praising God in their heart while this is going on? Whatever is going on around them, praising God in their heart, what does that matter? And my answer is always,
I agree wholeheartedly, and I find, you can take this for what it's worth, I never call into question whether or not someone believes that they're worshiping God. They believe they're worshiping God. I'm not going to call that into question. But it's clear from Scripture that not only does God have a certain way that he wants to be worshiped, which is what you're alluding to, but that not all forms of worship are equal. It's in the Psalms, it talks about how the fruit of the lips, and this is echoed later in the 13th chapter of Hebrews, the fruit of the lips is a superior way of worshiping God. This was something that the rabbis understood, which is one of the reasons why it appears that instruments were excluded from the synagogue form of worship. Was there was an understanding among the Jews that vocal praise of God was far superior to instrumental praise. So not all forms of worship are equal. And not all forms of worship are guaranteed to be received by God. So we shouldn't make the assumption that worshiping God with instruments and worshiping him with our mouth is equal to one another. Nor should we assume that just because we do it, God will accept it. because that logic just doesn't follow in other ways. If God just accepted whatever we wanted to do for worship, then we could just do whatever we wanted. But he has very specific ideas in mind of how he wants to be worshiped. So yeah, I agree with that. I just find it to be good policy never to question someone. They believe that they're worshiping God, okay. But let's talk now about the proper way to worship, what God has given us in his word. So, other questions or comments? You're going to hold us over if you make anything, so, you know, go ahead. Dan, is that a hand? Go ahead. Yes. Yeah.
My understanding, they were created during captivity.
Yes.
And evolved through the hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the transition also include instrumental music, following the temple practices in the synagogues to over time to really sing.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And the history of the synagogue is kind of murky. It's got a lot of fable mixed in there, but by the time we get to the first century, it's developed, you know, and at some point they did discard the use of instruments because they recognized there was a difference between temple worship and what they were doing in the synagogue. See,
I don't know if that tracked with the use of psalms through the years, as you pointed out.
Yeah, I think that would go along with what the Septuagint. The Septuagint, I think, is what gives us the clearest indication there of that evolution happening. But as far as the history goes, I'm not aware of anything. I'd have to do a little bit more digging, admittedly. I didn't go down that road. So, yeah. And I think I mentioned this last week. I'll say this one last thing. The Jews viewed the temple as being superior, and the synagogue, they didn't see the synagogue as being equal to the temple. That didn't happen until after Jerusalem was destroyed. It's only then that the synagogue begins to be raised in the estimation of Jews, that then they begin to call it a holy place, for example. So that destruction of the temple did change things a little bit, but certainly by the first century, they were not using instruments. They were just chanting psalms, singing psalms, and doing all the other things we've talked about. Thanks for that question, Dan. Next week, we'll talk about something else. I can't remember what it is, but I'll try to be prepared for it.